The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here,
reminding you that American Family Insurance agents can help build a customized renter's policy so you can protect stuff like this, or this, or even this. Case in point. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Christmas Eve is the most exciting night of the year for children. They wait for it for weeks and weeks, and they're on their best behavior just in case Santa's elves are in the area watching them to make sure they're being nice and not naughty. They go to their family parties and they put on their pajamas. And in my house, when my kids were little, my husband would trek outside into the cold with a string of jingle bells. He would hide around the side of the house near the family room window and jingle the bells. And I would act surprised and tell the kids, "Listen, do you hear that? Santa's getting close. You can hear his jingle bells." And then my little kids would run off to bed because they knew that they had to be in bed or Santa wouldn't come. They always chose one bedroom to sleep in on Christmas Eve, and I loved listening to them in whichever room they chose, giggling and excited and whispering until they finally fell asleep, and then, you know, Mom and Dad could begin the evening's work. It's a magical night and one of my favorite nights of the year. But tragedy is no respecter of dates and traditions. Tragedy can strike at any time, and it came knocking one Christmas Eve many years ago. This is the case of the Sauter children disappearance. Let's get into it. December 24th, 1945. The Sauter family is celebrating Christmas Eve in their two-story ranch-style home in Fayetteville, West Virginia. George Sauter and his wife Jenny had 10 children. So I'm sure Christmas was a fun time with that many kids, but also obviously a little stressful and chaotic. Their oldest child was in the Army and was not at home that year. The family had Christmas Eve dinner, and then the oldest sister, Marion, who was 17, handed out little gifts to all of her brothers and sisters from the dime store where she worked. That's such a sweet detail. What a nice big sister. 23-year-old John and 16-year-old George Jr. then went to bed, followed by their parents, who took the youngest child, Sylvia, who was only 2, to bed with them. The rest of the children were allowed to stay up late because it was Christmas Eve. The parents left 14-year-old Maurice and 12-year-old Martha kind of in charge of 10-year-old Louis, 8-year-old Jenny Irene, and 6-year-old Betty Dolly. They knew that the older kids would get the younger ones up to their attic rooms later to go to sleep. The parents went off to bed, telling them to have fun and make sure they closed up the chicken coop before they went to bed. 1945 was a very different time. I could never go to bed until I had tucked all my kids in and set the house alarm, but I mean, hello, look what I'm into. You get it. George and Jenny gave their kids a kiss and they closed their bedroom door. They had no idea that they would never see those little children again. At 12:30, just after midnight, the telephone rang. Jenny went to the house phone and answered it. The caller was a woman whose voice she did not recognize, and she asked for someone that Jenny didn't know. Jenny said, "You have the wrong number," and the woman laughed. Jenny later said she could hear laughter in the background as well and glasses clinking as if the caller was in a bar. She hung up the phone and then noticed that the family room lights were still on and the curtains were still open. That was unusual because the children knew to always turn the lights off and pull the curtains closed before they went to bed. 17-year-old Marion had fallen asleep on the couch, so Jenny assumed that her younger children had gone upstairs to their attic bedroom. She turned off the lights and closed the curtains and went back to bed. About half an hour later, around 1 a.m., Jenny heard a large bang, like something had hit the side of the house, and then she heard a rolling noise, like something was rolling down the roof. Now, this must have been kind of a wild neighborhood or something they expected on Christmas Eve, because if that happened at my house, I would get up and investigate, but she didn't. Jenny went back to bed without investigating the noise. It was Christmas Eve, and maybe she thought some people were drinking, you know, drove by her house and threw something just because they were being drunk and obnoxious. She dozed off, but then around 1:30 a.m., Jenny and George woke up to a strange smell. It was smoke. Their house was on fire. The couple panicked, grabbing little Sylvia out of her crib and running from their bedroom. George and Jenny's bedroom was on the first floor. John and George Jr. had gone to their room on the second floor of the house. And when the couple went to bed, like I said earlier, the children remained on the ground floor with them playing, but they slept in an attic room above the second floor. And that's where Jenny assumed they had gone to bed. As Jenny and George ran from their bedroom holding little Sylvia, they saw that there was a fire raging across the hall in George's study. 17-year-old Marion, who had fallen asleep on the couch, ran out right beside them. As George, Jenny, Marion, and Sylvia stood outside, they were relieved to see John and George Jr. come running from inside the home on the second floor. Both of them had singed hair and clothing from running down the burning stairs of the house. The fire was advancing very quickly. The father, George, kind of jumped up to the side of the house to see if he could see in the attic window. He was able to punch out that window, and it caused a very large gash from his wrist to his forearm, and he was bleeding profusely. Kind of clinging to the side of the house, he tried to get inside the attic bedroom, but there was too much smoke and the heat was unbearable. He then jumped back down onto the ground, and he and his sons went to get their ladder that was always in the backyard, but the ladder was gone. So then George ran to get one of the family trucks to back it up against the side of the house and to climb up on it. The truck would not start. He and his boys ran to the second vehicle. It would not start. So now we have a suspicious phone call, a suspicious noise, a missing ladder, and two vehicles that were working earlier in the day that wouldn't start. 17-year-old Marion went running to the next door neighbor's house to get help. The neighbors tried calling the fire department, but no one answered. It was Christmas Eve. Someone down the street sitting in a bar saw the flames and tried calling the fire department as well from the bar, but again, no answer. So obviously the fire department had closed down for the night so the firemen could go be with their families on Christmas Eve. The other issue the fire department was facing was a shortage of manpower because all of the younger men in the area, men that would normally become firemen and volunteer on the local fire department, they were off at war. Someone from the neighborhood bar then got in their car and drove to the fire chief's house. In the meantime, George and his sons were trying to get water from their well to fight the fire, but the well was frozen over. Jenny and Sylvia stood, screaming the children's names as George and his boys desperately tried to figure out ways to get inside. As all of this was happening, the fire consumed the attic and it collapsed entirely, falling down through the second floor of the house and onto the first floor. Any hope of saving the children from the attic was gone. Firemen eventually arrived. This is really unfathomable in this day and age, but it took them almost 7 hours to assemble and get to the scene of the blaze. The house was only like 3 miles from the fire station, so I know this is really hard to understand, but what they would do is, you know, one person was alerted, that person would call another fireman, that person would call another fireman, they'd all have to get dressed, go to the fire station, and I still don't understand how that took 7 hours. Apparently, this wasn't an area where someone was always manning the station. And like I said, back then, most firemen were just volunteers. Being a fireman wasn't their actual job. But after this horribly long delay, they did finally arrive, obviously far, far too late. The reports that I read said it was around 7:30, almost 8 o'clock in the morning, by the time the firemen got to the house. You know, and at that point, they weren't even needed. The house was just a smoldering pile of wood and debris. Very early on, after the fire was out, George and Jenny realized that things were not adding up. First, the children did not come to the window when George kind of jumped up to the side of the house and punched out the window. He knew that they would have heard him yelling, and they would have come over to the window, you know, even through the smoke, they would have come to the window. The fire hadn't been burning for long enough for all of the children to have been overcome by smoke. At least that's what all of the fire experts at the time said. So why didn't they come to the window when their dad was beating on the window and then eventually broke through it? It seemed like maybe they weren't even in their room at the time of the fire. Then George and Jenny started talking with the older boys about the ladder that was always in the same place in the backyard and that had gone missing. They looked around, they couldn't find it anywhere. And then, of course, there was the issue with the cars. Neither one of those cars would start at the time of the fire, and they wouldn't start even after the fire was out when tried again. But they had been working the day before. As the firemen began what I'm sure was their worst Christmas day ever, sorting through the wreckage of the house, they became very concerned. There were no bodies. At first, they were sure that they would begin coming across them and would most likely find them in a pile, as people tend to huddle together during a fire. But as the firemen dug and dug and hauled off piece after piece of burnt debris, they found nothing. There were no bones. There were no teeth. They did not find any of the things that are normally found after people are caught and die in a house fire. This is a gruesome detail, but the fire chief actually asked George, Jenny, you know, the two older boys, the daughter, if they could smell an odor of cooking or burning meat during the fire. I mean, that is really gruesome, but five burning bodies are going to put off a smell. As the family thought about it and talked about it, they said no, none of them had smelled anything like that. The fire chief knew that that was unusual because he had attended enough fires to know that you can, in fact, smell burning bodies of people who are dying in a fire. Not only that, but you can smell them after. There's apparently a very distinctive smell after a fire when there are bodies there. After a few days, Fire Chief F.J. Morris began telling the family and others in town that the fire must have been so hot that the bodies were completely incinerated, even though that is not what happens in a house fire, and many of the other firemen knew that. House fires simply do not burn hot enough to incinerate bones and all the teeth, let alone the bones and teeth of five people. Something definitely should have been found. A fire inspector from the state police department was brought in, and he made a determination that the house fire was started by faulty wiring. Now, how that conclusion was reached, if the fire was so hot that it supposedly incinerated the bones and the teeth, you know, but again, this is 1945. The fire chief wanted to continue investigating the fire location, but George Sauter, who couldn't stand the sight of the rubble any longer, took dirt moving equipment and pushed all of the rubble and several feet of dirt into the home's former basement. Now, of course, we know now that is the last thing that you should do. I'm sure he was terribly grieving. I understand he didn't want to look at it, but that was a huge mistake. I also am confused if he had all of these unanswered questions about where the kids were and they were feeling like the kids weren't there. Why would he do this? I think people do some strange things sometimes when they're grieving. Now, of course, you would never be allowed to do this today because the fire department would take control of the scene. But back then, the attitude was kind of, you know, it was your property. It was your decision. George was genuinely grieving the loss of his children. All accounts say he and Jenny were absolutely devastated. So I guess this was just an act of trying to erase the horrible tragedy as quickly as possible. Now, as we're talking about George, there are some things you need to know about him. He was born Giorgio Sadu in Tula, Sardinia, Italy, in 1895, and he immigrated to the United States at age 13 with his older brother, who then turned around and left the U.S. and went back to Italy as soon as George had cleared customs at Ellis Island. So this seems very strange. It was though the older brother was tasked with making sure that 13-year-old George made it into the United States safely, and then he turned right around and went back to Italy. Over the years, when asked about his past, George would never talk about why he left his homeland at only 13 years old and why he had left alone to go to a foreign country. He worked on the railroads of Pennsylvania and then became a truck driver in Smithers, West Virginia. He saved up his money and soon had enough to start his own trucking company, hauling fill dirt to construction sites and then hauling coal that was mined in West Virginia. He married Jenny, whose father had also immigrated from Italy and who owned a store there in Smithers, West Virginia. After they married, they settled on the outskirts of Fayetteville, which had a large population of Italian immigrants. George's business was very successful, and he was a very well-respected person in his community. George was known as a man who had strong opinions and wasn't afraid to share them. He openly spoke about his hatred for Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, and this led to him having some pretty serious arguments with other Italian immigrants in the community. George and Jenny's oldest son went off to fight in World War II, and then George became even more vocal about his opposition to Mussolini. In October of 1945, a life insurance salesman tried to sell George some insurance. After George told the salesman that he was not interested, the man said to him, "Your house will go up in smoke, and your children are going to be destroyed because of the dirty remarks you have been making about Mussolini." Now, on top of that, George later recalled that his sons came to him a few weeks before the house fire and said they noticed a strange man parked along the main highway through town, and that there were two men inside the car watching the younger Sauter children walk home from school. He also remembered that one of the Italian immigrants from the community kind of showed up at his house one day and noticed that George had rewired his home to be more modern. This other Italian community member pointed out the new fuse boxes on the outside of the Sauter home and said, "Those things will cause a fire someday." So when you start adding all of this up, the strange phone call with the woman laughing that sounded like it came from a bar, the sound of something hitting the house and then rolling off the roof, that could have been a liquor bottle that was then set on fire, the missing ladder, the cars that wouldn't start, it sure is starting to sound like this family had been targeted, doesn't it? And then I found out as I researched this event that back then they would have kind of a panel of three people on the coroner's jury to agree or disagree with the coroner's findings. Well, one of the men who was on that three-person jury that very, quickly decided that the children had died in the fire, even though there was absolutely no evidence of their bodies in the fire, that man was the insurance salesman who had told George Sauter that his house was going to burn down. A few weeks went by and Jenny and George began to come out of the fog of their grief, and they started really talking about all of the things that happened before the fire. As they talked, they realized that the fire inspector's conclusion of an electrical problem didn't make any sense, because they remembered that as they stood outside of the house and watched it burn, the Christmas lights were still on. They stayed on for a long time after the fire started burning and were on until the house burned down. If there was an electrical shortage because of the way things were wired back then, the Christmas lights would have lost power. Then in the midst of all of this, one of the Sauter family members found the missing ladder. It had been deliberately thrown down a 75-foot embankment and was lying at the bottom. When a telephone repairman was sent out to the house to fix the lines after the fire, he discovered that the phone line running to the house had not been burned through. It had been cut. When this information got out, another neighbor came forward and said that he had actually seen a man stealing a block and tackle out of George's yard. When that man was arrested, there were rumors going around that he admitted not only did he steal the block and tackle, but he also cut the telephone line. The problem with that story is there are no arrest records for this event, there are no police notes, and also no explanation as to why someone stealing a block and tackle out of a backyard would cut the phone line. Jenny began reading about house fires. She knew that after their house fire, their appliances like the stove and the refrigerator were still standing. Parts of the tin roof were also clearly visible in the rubble. Jenny started reading newspaper articles about house fires that had photos where you could see the appliances standing in the rubble, and in all of those articles, the victims' burnt remains were found inside the house. So she started to realize there's just no way that those five bodies were incinerated. Jenny even started taking animal bones and lighting them on fire. She would burn single bones, and then she would try burning piles of bones. She'd put wood and paper around them to really get the fire going as hot as possible. She did this over and over, making the fires bigger and hotter in a tin barrel. Each time she did this little unscientific experiment, the bones remained. So then Jenny went to the local crematorium and spoke with an employee there. Now, remember, there's no internet. You actually had to go out and talk to people. But that employee told her that even after the bodies in the crematorium were burned at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 hours, far longer and far hotter than the house fire had burned, that pieces of bone remain in those ashes. Jenny and George became convinced their kids weren't in that house. Spring of 1946. Jenny Sauter plants a flower garden over the remains of the former Sauter family home. She tended to that garden for the rest of her life, even though she and George were now pretty convinced their children were not buried in that wreckage. A man driving a bus through Fayetteville on the night of the fire came forward and told Jenny and George that he had seen people throwing what he called balls of fire at the Sauter house. Now, with this information in mind, Jenny was shocked as one day Sylvia, who was playing in the front yard of the former home, found a hard, green, burned-looking ball of rubber. The Sauters then began to believe that the house fire actually started on the roof and not by the electrical wiring, although there was no way to prove that anymore because there was just no evidence. And even if there had been, you know, fire science was not what it is now. Time goes by and people begin to come forward claiming that they had seen the children. One woman said that she saw a car sitting outside of the Sauter house as the house burned down and that the back seat was full of children who were peering out the windows watching the fire. Another woman claimed that she had served the children breakfast the day after Christmas in Charleston at a rest stop, and when they were finished eating, they got into a car with Florida license plates. So, you know, they've got these reports coming in. They're not really sure what to believe. And then things got really weird with Fire Chief Morris. Rumors began to circulate that Morris had actually found a heart on the night of the fire, but he thought that that detail was too gruesome to tell the Sauters. So he picked it up and buried it in a metal box. Like, what? This just goes to show you how naive people were, you know, about sciences and about fire science. The bodies are incinerated, but he found a heart. I mean, that would be one of the first things to burn. Someone went to George and Jenny and told them that the fire chief had confessed this to his priest. So George went to the priest, who confirmed that yes, Fire Chief Morris had told him that story about finding a heart. George then went right to Chief Morris and insisted that he dig up the box. Inside the box was a half-decomposed cow liver that Morris then admitted he had planted in hopes that these rumors would get back to George, and then once he saw the gruesome remains, he and Jenny would believe that their children were dead. That is just very bizarre. Again, this was a very different time, and maybe the fire chief did have good intentions, but that is just a very strange story. Both George and Jenny are relentless in trying to get to the bottom of what happened to their children. One time, George saw a photo of a girl in a magazine. The photo was of a young girl in a ballet class in New York City. He felt the girl looked just like his little Betty, and he drove all the way to New York to the girl's school and demanded to see the girl. Now, I can completely see why this was very scary for the school and for the girl, and his demands to see her were refused. George even wrote letters to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to ask for his help. Hoover did write back, but he told George it was a local matter, but that he would try to direct the Fayetteville authorities to be as much help as possible. These are just two examples of some of the extraordinary things George and Jenny did to try and find their children. August of 1949. George Sauter is able to persuade a Washington, D.C. pathologist, Dr. Oscar Hunter, to oversee a new search through the dirt at the location where the house burned down, the same location that George then filled in with dirt. He thought the story of the buried cow liver was strange. Wait till you hear this. This pathologist and his team undertake a very extensive dig through the dirt in the former basement of the Sauter home. During the dig, they found things like dictionaries and coins and toys that had not been burned. They also found several small bone fragments, and the pathologist said they were human vertebrae. These bone fragments were sent to a specialist with the Smithsonian Institute. There, they were confirmed by an expert to be lumbar vertebrae, and they were all from the same person. The expert said that because the vertebrae were fused, that meant the person would have been between 16 and 22 years old. Now, remember, Maurice was the oldest child missing, and he was only 14. But that didn't really matter, because this expert from the Smithsonian Institute then said that the bones had absolutely no evidence of being in a fire. He said that these bones had not even been burned at all, and then went even further in his report, stating that as an expert, he could confirm that after a house fire, no matter how severe it was, full skeletons would be found, and that if full skeletons were not found, that meant there were no people in the house fire. It is then determined that these vertebrae bones that were found were already in the dirt that George used as fill dirt to push into the basement of his former home, because some of the dirt had come from a nearby local cemetery in Mount Hope. But no one could figure out how loose bones got out of a buried coffin and into the soil. So yes, this is a very strange case that just gets stranger and stranger. At this point in time, the case started receiving some national attention. Nowadays, if five children disappeared in a house fire, that would be worldwide news, but that wasn't the case back then. Pressure starts to mount on authorities to make some definitive statement of some kind on where these children could possibly be. The West Virginia legislature held two hearings on the case, and in 1950, after those hearings, Governor Okie L. Patterson, along with the state police superintendent, declared the case, quote, hopeless. The case was closed. The FBI continued to pursue the case as a kidnapping, but after 2 years, they closed their case as well. 1952. George and Jenny Sauter were not about to give up. They continuously had flyers printed up with photos of their children on them, offering a $5,000 reward that they then doubled to $10,000 for anyone that came forward with information that would solve even one of the missing children's cases. They even bought and erected two billboards, one at the side of the old house and a second one along US Route 60 near Anstead, that had the same information as the flyers on them. One woman saw the billboard on the interstate and remembered something. Her name was Ida Crutchfield, and she ran a Charleston hotel. She claimed to have seen the children about a week after the fire. She said the children came into her hotel around midnight with two men and two women, and all of them appeared to be of Italian heritage. When she tried to talk to the children, one of the adults looked at her angrily and then spun around and began yelling at the children in Italian. One woman reported that she thought Martha was in a convent in St. Louis. A bar patron in Texas claimed to have overheard two people talking about a fire in West Virginia on Christmas Eve, so that man went to the police. George tracked down every single lead, driving all over the country to talk to these people telling these stories. 1967. A woman in Houston, Texas, wrote a letter to George and Jenny, telling them that their son, Louis, revealed his true identity to her one night after having too much to drink. This woman told George that both Louis and Maurice were living in Texas somewhere. George drove all the way to Texas to speak to the woman who got police involved and then helped them track down the two brothers. George sat and talked with the men, and they vehemently denied being his sons. But George's son-in-law later reported that George was never fully convinced they were not his boys. After this, the family got a letter postmarked from Central City, Kentucky, with no return address. Inside the letter was the photo of a young man, this photo, maybe late 20s or so, who strongly resembled Louis. On the back of the photo was written, Louis Sauter, I love brother Frankie, LLIL boys, A90132 or Pre-5. George and Jenny hired another private detective to go to Central City and try and locate the man. The PI took the Sauter's money and they never saw him again. This is such a sad story. You really get a feel for these two people, these two parents who loved their children so much and who were just desperate to find out what happened to them. I am fully convinced they did not die in that fire. But what on earth became of them? Some of them could still be alive. Do they know who they are? Do they have any memory of what happened to them? Were they brainwashed into believing that they couldn't talk about what happened to them for fear that something bad might happen to them or their parents or their children? This is just a fascinating and very tragic Christmas mystery. George Sauter died in 1969. Jenny, Marion, George Jr., and Sylvia continued to look for the other children. John would never speak about the night of the fire, just once to an interviewer saying his family needed to forget about it and move on. We all deal with grief differently. After George died, Jenny stayed in the family home, the home that they had built elsewhere after the fire, and she wore black for the rest of her life. She put up fencing around the family home and added some additional rooms to accommodate relatives and grandchildren. For the rest of Jenny's life, she went several times a week to the flower garden she had planted over the remains of their former home, and she tended to it lovingly until her death in 1989. Only then did her surviving children have the two billboards torn down. Now the surviving Sauter children work with their own children to continue to investigate leads and generate publicity for the case. Some of them believe that the children might have been taken from the home to save them by someone who knew that the Sicilian Mafia was going to start the home on fire, and that person wanted to protect at least the younger kids if they couldn't get everyone out. They also believe that if the older children remembered who they were as they grew, they might have stayed away in order to protect their parents and their surviving siblings. Sylvia Sauter Paxton, the little girl who was saved from her crib at only 2 years old, she just died a few months ago. She once said, "I was the last one of the kids to leave home. I would stay up with father for hours and hours talking about what might have happened. I experienced their grief for a long time." Sylvia firmly believed her siblings did not die in the fire, and she told her own children, "I do not want this story to die. I want to do everything I can to keep my promise to my parents that I will keep this story alive." So I hope that in some small way, me sharing this story with you helps Sylvia keep that promise. I doubt we will ever know what happened to all of the Sauter children, but I do know one thing. Those kids were loved by their parents, and that father and that mother spent their entire lives trying to find them. It is beautiful and tragic and heartbreaking all at once. I want to send my love to the surviving Sauter family members. I hope they're doing well. And who knows, there's always a chance, right? There's always that slim chance that we could find an answer to the question, what happened to the Sauter children on Christmas Eve? All those years ago. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I hope you're enjoying your holiday season. Thanks so much for spending a few minutes of your day with me. If you haven't subscribed to my channel and you like the content, I wish you would do that. It really, really helps us creators out. Stay safe and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
It's a great time to save big on everything for your next project at Menards. Get free estimates fast on new energy-efficient windows from Jeld-Wen. Choose from vinyl or wood windows and customize the perfect size and unique features for your home. Save big on all Jeld-Wen windows today. View our entire selection of Jeld-Wen windows on Menards.com. Plus, the weekly flyer for other great deals happening now. Save big.